Okay, great.
Okay.
Well, you did an awesome job, and you almost answered the second question.
Yeah.
Do you want to still... We can still ask it, and then always cut redundant.
Yeah, I guess so. Can you give any more examples of promising quantum 2.0 technologies?
Yeah, so I guess I've talked about secure communication, and I briefly mentioned sensing applications. Mm-hmm. And so just focusing on the quantum network side of things, you know, quantum sensing can be improved with a quantum network. So if you've paid attention a few years ago to the news around the imaging of the black hole, mm-hmm. That was obtained through many telescopes distributed all across the world, and they recorded the waveforms of the incoming light mm-hmm. from that astronomical object. And then by combining those waveforms a certain way, you can generate the image.
Oh, okay.
And that allows you to take really high-resolution images of very, very distant astronomical objects. That was all at radio wavelengths. If you wanted to do that at optical wavelengths, then you would have to find a way either to record the optical waveforms, which we currently don't have a way to do because mm-hmm. they're so high frequency, or literally send the photons, send the light and interfere them between the different telescopes.
Oh.
And so the way they do astronomical imaging in the optical regime with this interferometric technique is to actually send light between the telescopes. But they experience loss. And if you want to scale that up, so currently it's like 300 meters between telescopes. Mm-hmm. If you want to scale that up and achieve higher and higher resolution, you'll get more and more loss.
Mm-hmm.
And so okay. there's a proposal that says if you have a photon that you create on Earth, and so it's not the stellar photons, it's what we call the terrestrial photons, right? So you create a photon and you send it to two telescopes. You don't know which telescope it will go to,
mm-hmm.
And have that photon interfere with the light coming from the astronomical object.
Okay.
It's equivalent to sending the photons from the two telescopes and interfering them.
Oh.
And what's nice is if you have a high enough rate of creating that terrestrial photon, then you can overcome the loss issues associated with that distance.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah.
So just for my own understanding, so you have multiple kind of stations around the globe trying to make a measurement of some astronomical object like a black hole that's mm-hmm. many, many light years away.
Mm-hmm.
And they can take those images in radio waves,
mm-hmm.
but they, in order to take those images in optical, so like the visible light that we see every day, they need to, I guess, which photons are interfering with each other?
Yeah, so the photons received from the astronomical object
mm-hmm.
are, in the case of radio waves, they're recorded, and then the waveforms are digitally interfered with each other. And they can do that, yeah. And so, whereas optically, we have no way of recording an optical waveform. It oscillates too quickly.
Oh, okay.
So there's no way to get the phase information, which is critical to interference, to see. I don't want to get too bogged down in the details, but it's kind of like a Fourier transform.
Mm-hmm.
So the spatial position of the light that came from the astronomical object can be determined by basically doing measuring it at two locations
mm-hmm.
and looking at the relative phase of the light received by those at those two locations.
Oh, okay, makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense.
So optical waveforms can't be recorded. So how do you interfere them? Well, you literally send them to each other. But then you have to traverse the distance between the telescopes.
Mm.
And then because of loss of the photon, you can only go so far.
Mm.
And so the idea is have a resource on Earth where you have another photon. And that photon is in a superposition, actually, of being between the two telescopes. And by interfering that photon with the light from the star at the two telescopes, you can do the same thing, except now you're not limited so much by the distance. You can increase the distance. Yes.
That is so cool.
Yeah. It's cool because it's like astronomy, and then it's like a network that's spanning distance. So it's like, whereas in the lab, quite often we're thinking really small. And quite often with quantum, you'll hear it's the very small and the very cold. Mm-hmm. What's great about photons is it doesn't need to be cold. It can be big. Yeah, it can be the size of the internet, basically, yes. Once we get to that stage, of course. Yeah.
And what is the reason that it needs to be cold?
So usually when people are saying that it needs to be cold, they're thinking of matter-based systems, so single atoms, superconducting qubits, just in the name itself, it implies cold, so superconducting. Mm. Any kind of material system, to get it to exhibit those properties of superposition and entanglement, and have it stick around long enough to measure it and not decohere immediately, you need to cool them down. Mm-hmm. Because you'll have collisions, you'll have thermal excitations of the atoms, and all of that can, you know, degrade the degree of entanglement that you want. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the quantum computers that are being built, they rely on cooling the mm-hmm. atoms and the circuits so that they work in the quantum regime. Oh. Whereas photons, they don't interact readily with the environment, mm-hmm. you know, so they don't lose their coherence readily. They mm-hmm. can be sent through a really thin strand of glass that we call an optical fiber over really long distance. And you can, of course, they might, you know, rotate their polarization. They might get lost, you know, and that's kind of the worst thing that happens is they get lost, they get bounced off, and they're no longer guided. But it's amazing. You can still get quite good rates in terms of how many photons you can send from point to point. And you can adjust at the end what may have happened to distort the state of the photon, but it's still there and it's still coherent and you can still do something with it. And that's all room temperature. You don't need anything cool. Mm. And what's also great, and this is part of what my group did, is you can just use optical fiber that's already in the ground mm. that's used for the internet. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't need anything special in terms of new infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Of course, to make it really, really good, then sometimes you might want to make more specialty fiber and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But as we demonstrated, even the fiber that's in the ground already can take you from a lab on a campus over to a public space and have people interact with the photons there.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And we're going to have you give the full story of this. But yes. Also, just for listeners, when we say coherence, we mean sort of like it kind of has the quantum properties that we're interested in. And when we say decoherence, then it's kind of lost the quantum properties of interest. If that's
yeah, correct. That's right. You can think of waves in water and... you know, you drop a little pebble in water and you see this kind of concentric circles going out. And then if you were to like slap the water or put another pebble in, it would cause it to lose some of that nice, smooth oscillation. Mm-hmm. And that's decoherence. That's one way of understanding decoherence.
Yeah, that's a really good visual.
Yeah, that's a really
good visual. And so just to go back to the images of astronomical objects, is there... could you give an example of like an object that quantum could image better, or like something that like an image that could be improved on?
Yeah, and I'll just say, you know, this is really at the cutting edge in terms of like the proposal itself is not that old. It's I think 2010 or 2011, and the research around it has brought up all kinds of issues, like, okay, you know, in what limit will you actually see an advantage? And when you get to these larger distances between the telescopes, you also you may get higher resolution, but you'll get fewer photons per frequency bin, or like if you were to slice up your frequency space into tiny little slices, then you get less light per mm-hmm. per slice. So you know, it doesn't come at the cost of nothing. Mm-hmm. There's trade-offs. Mm-hmm. And so we've looked into it quite a bit. And it turns out it has to be a relatively bright star. And I think we have identified one, but we haven't published it yet. And I don't want to say because we haven't fully. Yeah. But there's definitely like a range, like a narrow range over which you can show quantum advantage. Mm-hmm. And this is always the problem, right? Yeah. In quantum information science, people ask, you know, what can you do? And it's like, well, in this really specific situation where you have this number of parameters and so on, and if you consider, you know, the, you know, what are you comparing against, you know, let's talk about what you're comparing against, and so there's a lot of caveats around it, and mm-hmm. And it's no different for quantum sensing. Actually, for quantum sensing, it's probably even worse in certainly, because if you blast something with enough light, usually you can make up for any deficiencies and loss and so on,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And now when it comes to and it's kind of the same idea for astronomical sensing. You can, the brightest stars, you tend to be able to see at higher resolution, which makes sense. You have more light to work with. And so you're just trying to find that regime where it's not as bright maybe as you would need it to be to do it classically, but we can do it quantum mechanically.
Yeah.
So, right? So you just have to find that regime.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah,
I want
to
ask a question that kind of branches off of that a little bit. Many use cases for quantum 2.0 are kind of largely unknown, and we need a lot of input from other disciplines to find these use cases. And as you mentioned, they can be kind of narrow, can be kind of hard to pin down when you can get a quantum advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, how can someone from a different discipline learn about quantum 2.0 and learn how to apply it to their work?
Yeah, I think everyone has something to bring to it. You know, I personally think that we have just gotten the tip of the iceberg in terms of what is possible. And I think there are many angles you could take. There's kind of the practical angle where you look at what protocols are already out there, and then you think about implementing them in new ways.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess, you know, in a way, the public quantum network that we're going to talk about is one example of that, where we didn't really change the technology so much. We just applied it in a new way, in a new arena. And then it raised more questions about how to fix these problems. You could also think it from a fundamental or a foundational perspective. And, you know, if I think there's still quite a bit of work to be done at the fundamental level.
Mm-hmm.
And that might just be, you know, you might pick a particular platform that you already have a lot of expertise in, like material science, and you're really good at making certain things. And then you find a niche where, hey, my technique actually would be useful for that quantum computing platform.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of times this is what happens. Scientists in a different field, they'll see, you happen to overlap with me right here, and actually I have a lot of stuff I can do to improve what you do in that space where we overlap. So I would call that kind of fundamental level sort of things. And then there's the foundational element, which I think is under-researched, and it has to do with kind of the underlying meaning.
Yes.
Which, you know, honestly, everyone wants to know, wants to understand this, right? And if you keep probing and probing a physicist, eventually you're going to get to a quantum interpretation, whether or not that physicist is aware that they are using an interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there needs to be a lot more light on that area to bring it to the undergraduate level even. It's not even at the undergraduate level in terms of training, to know what theories are out there that can kind of give some idea of what might be going on beyond what we currently understand. So what is causing entanglement? What is the mechanism for entanglement?
Mm-hmm.
It's really fascinating, and I think it actually draws more attention if you start to address that than if you just say practical, technological things for some people. I think everyone's different, but almost every time I do outreach, everyone asks that foundational question, and I myself am doing some remediation of my own academic training and trying to, like, I should read up on that. So I have a more complete answer for them, then I can point them in different directions where to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
I could go on and on about that element of things. Yeah, but I mean, just one example is, you know, people see in the Marvel movies and so on, they see quantum interpretations right at play. You know, they see many worlds happening, you know, Ant-Man and so on. And that's just one perspective. And there are many fascinating perspectives that you could have on what could be actually going on. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a hesitancy to lead any physics student down that path because there's not much funding.
Yes, yes.
And but I think the more and more quantum technology is in kind of the public awareness, the more we're going to have to address it. And mm-hmm. so more physicists should be ready to address it. Mm. And I would be excited to see more physicists study it because I think there are things we can test. And the more that people think about it, the more ideas we'll have.
So is it like, just for clarification, the more that we understand about like the foundational, like for instance, what the many world interpretation, or not many world, what the quantum interpretations are, the more kind of applications that we can provide?
Potentially. I mean, okay. I guess I see it as a paradigm shift. You know, you go through something in your life and suddenly you're like, oh, I just see the past events differently, or if I see from this person's perspective on my problem, I never would have thought of doing it that way. But because this, I saw what this person's doing, I'm going to try it. Okay, it's out of the box thinking. Okay, because I think quite often we think this is it. You know, we've seen it from all angles, mm-hmm. but we are still in a box, and I think that's definitely the case for physics, especially. Well, we're basically doing the Copenhagen interpretation in the lab,
yeah.
and that's fine. But if you really think outside of that a little bit, you might think of experiments that you never would have thought of otherwise.
Okay.
Either to test the theories or just because you're thinking differently. You're not thinking in terms of wave function collapse. You're instead thinking in terms of entanglement being extended to your measurement devices. And that might lead you to doing a different way than you would otherwise.
That's very true. Yeah, yeah, we definitely, we're kind of talking about, we have these quantum mechanical properties like entanglement that we've touched on, and then there are also different interpretations of what is like the mechanistic driver, happening. So they mentioned the many worlds theory, or the many worlds interpretation, which is, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you have a particle in this sort of indeterminate state of it's oscillating up and down, and it's oscillating side to side, and you don't know which direction it's oscillating in until you measure it. In the many worlds interpretation, once you measure it, there's a one world where it's oscillating up and down, and one world where it's oscillating side to side.
Yeah.
And you have just kind of entered one of the forks.
Right.
And so when like folks like Gina and Mari are doing quantum mechanics in the lab, they're sort of operating on one sort of paradigm of the mechanistic drivers of these kind of quantum mechanical properties, and there's not really a strong initiative to really like kind of question that paradigm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Very well put.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, and I really like your argument for, you know, it might make you think differently. I think human creativity and mm-hmm. scientific creativity is something that, I don't know, it feels very anomalous, I love the idea that, like, taking seriously a different paradigm might lead you down a completely different path. I think that's just really fascinating.
Yes, so do I. I mean, and honestly, this is new for me. You know, I didn't really think about these things too much until the last year or so. So I'm definitely not the expert on this, but I'm so fascinated by it, I can't stop talking about it.
Was it sort of the interacting with the public and their questions that kind of got you along?
I think that was a big thing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And actually, it was on a radio show in Chicago. So Paul Kwiat and I were on a radio show. And it was Tori Ryder. And she asked us this question. She said, my father was a mathematical economist. And he always used to say that the thermos was the best invention because how did it know whether to keep things hot or cold? And then she said, how do the photons know, the entangled photons, how do they know what to do when one is measured? And there was radio silence. as I grappled with the fact that I was not, at that moment, I thought, I really wish I had in my pocket right now that wonderful synopsis of all the different theories and what and their implications.
Yeah.
And I missed that. And but at the end, we just said, that's a great question. That's still an open question. You know, yeah. The scientists don't know. And I said, and that's partly why we want more people to be interacting with this, so there we get more diversity of thought around these questions.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I kind of used the question to to boost what we were doing. But yeah. I do believe that. And then I went and was like, I got to get some books on the topic and start building up my resource of being able to answer in a way that I would be more satisfied with. So yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I think it's wonderful because that's the kind of question that really pulls people in.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, she's a great. are you all. You've all pulled us here. So
And and could you give us kind of like a brief overview of like the different interpretations for how they know?
Well, I'll just give you one other one because I'm not prepared to do the others. I'm still in my mode of research in that area, but one of them is Bohmian mechanics, and so this is David Bohm. It's really, once you start reading his works and so on, you can't help but be pulled into his story, you know, as a person. Mm-hmm. So this was back during, you know, the making of the atomic bomb. So he actually was a student of Oppenheimer. And some of his work even became classified that he did with Oppenheimer. But he also had slight interests in kind of left-leaning sorts of ideas. And so he ended up having to leave the U.S. Mm. But his main theory is this concept that what we would call a non-local hidden variables.
Oh, okay.
And actually, Bohm inspired John Bell, in the who came up with the Bell test in the 1960s. That was the first test for entanglement. Mm-hmm. And the Bell test allows you to test to see, indeed, if these, you know, two particles are correlated, no matter how far apart they are, such that they're instantaneously changed when one is measured. And he was able to make a test for that. Now, that test shows that you can't explain the correlations using, you know, some parameter or variable about the universe that you just haven't measured yet that works locally.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
But because the particles are very far.
Yes,
apart.
Yes. But what David Bohm found was there is a possibility for non-local hidden variables. So you still have to accept this concept of non-locality, that things can influence each other no matter the distance between them. Mm. And then his theory led to this concept of what's called pilot wave theory, that basically the wave functions that govern quantum mechanics are not the end of the story, that there's a super wave function, that there's something that forms the wave functions. And the analogy he gives is a gamer. So you have a game and you have someone playing the game. Right. And even within that, you have multiple kind of like if you start at kind of the hardware is guided by the software. The software is guided by the gamer. Mm-hmm. And who knows, maybe the gamer is guided by something, you know, and it just continues. And he, you know, philosophically, at least, he considered many super, what he called super implicate orders that all influence the suborders. Mm-hmm. But that's a basic idea. Oh. You can see it gets really deep really fast.
Yes.
And I just love it. And I don't know much about it, but I just love it. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, that's a great example. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's see. I feel like we talked about Quantum 2.0.
Yes.
Public Quantum Network. Okay. So you alluded to the idea of using quantum communication to communicate between a lab and, say, a public space.
Yes.
Could you discuss the Public Quantum Network that you have been a part of constructing? What's kind of the history and motivation behind the project, and what's the current status and future plans?
Yeah. So this started when I had to write a grant proposal. So, you know, when you start to lead a research group, you have to get money to fund your research group. And the proposal call said, think outside the box. Okay. This seems to be a theme. Anyway, and so I was like, okay, And I was somehow inspired by my dad, actually. So I mentioned my dad, he brought these personal computers for the first time into classrooms that he was teaching. Mm-hmm. And I was so impacted by that as a kid. I think that influenced why I was kind of techie growing up and why mm-hmm. I loved to do research when I was an undergrad. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wouldn't it be great to do the same thing for the technology I'm working on now?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't it be so cool if, you know, I could bring that and you know, see that development and start that development for quantum technology, just like for personal computers. You know, so the analogy is, you know, that we made is cell phones, you know. So you start out with these really basic wireless communication devices, and then they're just phones for a long time, and then the more and more people were able to use them and start mm-hmm. to code and think of ideas and start to, you know, influence applications, now they're just exploded in terms of what you can do, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, to do the same thing with quantum technology, which currently only has a handful of applications, like I said, very niche things like, oh, if you, you know, you can do this in this case and so on. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great if more and more people were thinking about how to use it and they came up with applications the scientists wouldn't even think of yeah. because we're all stuck in the lab in the Copenhagen interpretation and not thinking of any new ideas. And so yeah. that was really the motivation. So I started asking around. And, you know, quantum networks, what they are is basically you have particles of light called photons. They are entangled such that measuring one changes the other. And you just send them out. You distribute them. And like I mentioned earlier, you can do communication that is, you know, sensitive to eavesdroppers, so it can be really secure. If you, you know there's an eavesdropper present, you know that that's not secure, so you wait until they're not present and so on. And there are a handful of networks throughout the world, some varying sizes. The largest one is in China. And so I knew it was possible to build a network. And so you just need to identify, okay, what fiber optics are available. So I started asking, and it was one of those serendipitous things. Like everyone I asked was like, oh, you should talk to so-and-so. And that person would be like, oh, I know just the person. And it just built this network. And I ended up being led to the fiber optic network that was installed in 2009 from funding of the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act of 2009 that was meant to bring broadband internet service to underserved communities. Okay. And you know, in my vision, that's precisely what I wanted. I was like, I don't want to just keep this nestled in the, you know, ivory tower. I want to bring this out and get the ideas from the folks on, you know, in the real world out there. And what's great is this UC2B network, Urbana-Champaign Big Broadband, they were really enthusiastic because that's the vision they had for building that network to begin with. It would bring technology to people who don't typically get that technology mm-hmm. first. Mm-hmm. And so enthusiasm was building and building, and we figured out which fibers to use. We figured out how to make the source so that it could work with those fibers and so on. And just people just were, I don't know, it was very, you know, certain times there's this idea and everyone just gathers around and just works together.
Yeah.
You know, it was amazing. Amazing students, you know, Paul Quiat and his team, amazing. And then it's not, because it's public, the library, we went to the library, and their Urbana Free Library, they're all about technology to the people, right? Mm-hmm. So they have computers with internet for people to come and use, and their theme is to provide things to the community. So they were also so enthusiastic, yeah, and everyone had input, and, you know, and when you go to the public, you have to explain things, you have to have, you know, artwork, icons, things like that, and just everyone came together, and so we got the technology working, and then we had our launch event, and you know, it was standing room only in the library. So that showed us that people are wanting to learn more about this. Mm-hmm. People are excited, and there is a lot of potential there to do what I imagined, which is that to engage people. Mm-hmm. So that really continues to drive us, and we've made it fully automated. We're now going to install a second node at the library. So currently what people can do at the library is a Bell test, testing that the photons are entangled that we send to them from the lab. And